You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It's The Bigger Picture and I'm Mira Sivasodhi. Now, your brain is the hub of your nervous system. It's made up of 100 billion nerve cells, about the same as the number of trees in the Amazon rainforest. Now, each cell is connected to around 10,000 others. So the total number of connections in your brain is the same as the number of leaves in the rainforest, about just 1,000 trillion. And joining us today to talk about brain activity are Professor Peter Mitchell, editor of the British Journal of Psychology, and Dr. Kirsten McKenzie, a doctor of philosophy in cognitive neuroscience. Welcome both of you to the show.
It's great to be here again, and I'm delighted to be able to take part in this fascinating discussion.
It is. It sounds interesting. And welcome, Kirsten.
Thank you very much for having us.
Okay. There is this urban myth that we only use 10% of our brains. Is it true?
I can say definitively not at all.
Yeah.
So I think the idea from this urban myth is that we're only using 10% of our brains at any one time, and what could we possibly do if we were using more of our brain? But what you find is actually our brain is partitioned up to specific areas that are involved in specific things. So, for example, you wouldn't need to use your part of your brain involved in smelling things if you're trying to remember days of the week. So what we find is that the brain is very well defined in the areas that need to do certain things. And for example, if you're doing something that's incredibly difficult for the first time, you're going to recruit a lot more brain areas than if you're doing something that you find to be very easy and very automatic. Mm-hmm. So you find that the amount of brain power that you're using is very well related to how well you're able to do a particular task or how difficult you're finding it.
Right.
So the idea that we could do more if you're using more of your brain is incorrect, because actually you're finding it much more difficult to do that.
Okay. If we do push our brain, thinking that it's, you know, it's being underutilized, will that cause any problems for us?
Well, you don't need to think of the brain being underutilized. You can think of it more in the way, supposing you developed your muscles more, supposing you did some training and exercises, your muscles would grow more, you'd be able to achieve greater things in terms of fitness and exercise in a physical way. And I guess one can think of that as a kind of analogy for the brain. If you exercise the brain more and challenge the brain more, then you're going to see the brain develop more. But that doesn't mean to say that there's a large capacity of the brain not being used. It just means that you can develop further if you exercise the brain.
Okay, so we've got it all wrong then, really, the understanding of us not utilizing it. It's just muscles, as you explained.
Well, the brain's more than a muscle.
Yeah, it's got 1,000 trillion, you know, leaves, like in the rainforest of Amazon.
I mean, obviously the brain has great potential.
Yes, it does. And the brain not only controls an individual's conscious thought processes and voluntary movements, it also controls involuntary movements and conscious thought processing and other vital bodily functions. Now, can you elaborate and, you know, help us understand this a bit better?
Well, basically, the brain is the center of the nervous system, and it controls absolutely every other part of your body. So all experiences that you have, whether they're external or internal, mental, physical, or otherwise, these are all coming from your brain. So as far as it, reality is concerned, if it doesn't come from your brain, then it actually doesn't exist for you, whether it's really out there or not. If it doesn't come from your brain for you, it just isn't there. And the way that your brain processes things is very much dictated by past experience and how much experience you have with something, how well familiar you are with it. So your brain compares previous occurrences with what's going on currently to sort of look at the most optimal way of dealing with things. So the best way of explaining this is sensory feedback. So when you're walking, what your brain is doing is telling you to walk, but it's also monitoring how you're walking, predicting how you're walking, and then giving you commands sort of queued up in advance. And you can tell this from particularly looking at small children. So small children have quite jerky body movements. They're not very fluid. Mm-hmm. They're not very coordinated. And this is because small children can't predict the sensory consequences of what they're doing. They don't know how it feels when they move their foot and place it on the ground and then move forward. They can't predict what's going to happen. So they have to wait for the sensory feedback to come back from the nerves and the muscle fibers into the brain. Mm-hmm. And then look at how well this works and then formulate another movement based on this feedback. So this is why they're quite jerky, whereas as we become older, we become much better at predicting how things should feedback. And so we can queue up more and more commands in advance.
Yeah.
And so the brain makes shortcuts like this all of the time, and these are very advantageous. So, for example, a person who can react very fast is more likely to survive. So if you see a snake or something that wants to eat you, if you can react very, very fast to that, it's better than if you have to sort of stand there and think, now, what do I need to do in this situation? This thing is dangerous. What's the best course of action? But sometimes these shortcuts can be incorrect and can cause problems for people, because these shortcuts aren't necessarily something that people are consciously aware of. And this is part of what we study for cognitive neuroscience.
Okay. And if you see, you know, somebody responds slower than the other, what does that tell you about the brain?
I'm glad you're asking that question, actually.
She said about, you know, if you see a snake, some of us respond really quickly, whereas some of us, you know, don't.
Yeah, I think this is a good question. And my own specialism is research into autism. And one thing we find with people with autism is that they are somewhat slow to respond to social cues, but they seem to be quick to respond to events happening in the physical world. And at the present time, we're able to record these different responsiveness at the level of attention, specifically at the level of eye movements. Mm-hmm. So we can use an eye tracking device, for example, which in itself is a tool of cognitive neuroscience, to determine what it is in the world that somebody with autism is looking at. And what we find, as I said, is that they look very quickly and respond very quickly to physical events, but slower to social events, like, for example, an expression in somebody's face. Whereas we find that people without autism, clinically normal people, show the opposite priority, processing priority. They're very quick to look at an expression in somebody's face, but relatively slow, or a bit slower, to respond to events in the physical world. Mm-hmm. So what we're able to do with the tools of neuroscience is measure not just this level of activity at eye movements, but also at the level of the cortex of the brain. We can see if the speed of attention is faster or slower in some individuals at the level of the cortex of the brain.
So everyone's cortex of the brain is different?
Yes. Yeah. It's quite like fingerprints, actually.
Right.
So while there's basic structures that everyone has in common, the way that these are organized is ever so slightly different in every individual. So looking at somebody's the convolutions in the cortex is a bit like looking at a fingerprint.
Wow, and it's individual to every person. Every person's different.
So, I mean, it's this, it's the same as a fingerprint in that everyone has the same basic structure of a fingerprint, mm-hmm. but no one's is exactly the same. And it's the same for the cortical structures
as well.
How
interesting is that? Right, okay. When you talk about neuroscience, what are you referring to?
Neuroscience is the use of technology, modern technology, to perhaps generate an image of the brain, not just an image of the static brain, but an image of the working and living brain. Mm-hmm. So if you think about two particular tools that we could use, one would be magnetic resonance imaging, mm-hmm. and another would be EEG, electroencephalogram.
Okay.
So magnetic resonance imaging, we could use either structural MRI or we could use functional MRI. Structural MRI is going to give us an exquisite and high resolution image of the structure of the brain, and it's like an X-ray except much, much better.
Right, like when you have, for an example, if you have an orthopedic condition, a structural MRI is what we'd go for.
That's right, it's going to give us a very precise image, a very high resolution image, much better than an X-ray would.
Mm-hmm.
But functional MRI can do something a little bit different. It can tell you not just about the structure of the brain, but about what parts of the brain are active as the person is engaged in a particular task.
Wow.
So we can generate an image of the brain, and the way we do this graphically is to show parts of the brain lighting up as the person is doing a particular task.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, supposing the person is looking at something and their visual cortex would be active. In that case, we can see the rear part of the brain, the occipital lobe, lighting up. Whereas if the person is speaking, producing language, then we might see Broca's area lighting up, which is towards the front of the brain. And we can see this lighting up as the person is actually engaged in these tasks. Whereas EEG, an electroencephalogram, is a net of electrodes that can tell you, it can also tell you which parts of the brain are active, but on a coarser level, it's not quite as precise in its resolution. Having said that, it can give you a very precise information about the speed of processing. So, for example, imagine that the participant in your study is, let's say, listening to music or listens to some stimulus. Then you might see a signal in a particular part of the brain that's showing the person has registered, is processing this information. Then you can see how the signal changes rapidly over time as the person's processing is progressing.
Right. How effective is an MRI, functional MRI or EEG, in measuring this sort of brain activity? How accurate is it?
Right. Well, it depends on what you're trying to discover. So for the fMRI, this can give us a very detailed anatomical image of the brain, and then we can look at the areas of the brain involved in particular activity. So fMRI looks at the oxygen in blood flow. It's called the BOLD effect, blood oxygenation level dependent effect. And so what's happening is that fMRI uses an enormous magnet. And so, for example, a normal fridge magnet would be around what we call 50 Gauss, whereas an fMRI is based on Tesla. Tesla is at least 10,000 Gauss. So a very weak MRI would be about 600 times stronger than a fridge magnet. And what it does is it uses the magnetic field to give us tissue densities and to look at the oxygenation in the brain. So when you're doing a particular task, you're using oxygen in the neurons. So when the neurons fire and they're working out what it is that you need to do, they're using oxygen, which is why it's so important that we have oxygen in our brains and why we need to keep breathing. And so what the scanner does is it looks at the areas where the oxygen's been depleted because the area's been active. And so this tells us the areas that have been working when we're doing a particular task. So we can look at areas involved to within about half of a millimeter.
Okay.
With fMRI, whereas EEG gives us to millisecond timing because it's looking at electrical activity from groups of neurons. But because it's groups of neurons, we're a bit fuzzier on exactly where this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
So while we have fantastic timing with EEG, we have a bit less spatial resolution.
Okay, but would you say the fMRI is more accurate? In measuring brain activity?
It's more accurate in telling you where, whereas EEG is far more accurate in telling you when.
When, okay, all right. Coming up, we'll find out more about some groundbreaking research Dr. Gerson has been working on illusory sensations. Up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It's The Bigger Picture and I'm Mira Sivasodhi. We are talking about brain activity today with Professor Peter Mitchell, the editor of the British Journal of Psychology, and Dr. Kirsten McKenzie, Doctor of Philosophy in Cognitive Neuroscience. Now, Dr. Kirsten, you have used fMRI to sort of measure medically unexplained symptoms. What do you mean by medically unexplained symptoms?
Well, medically unexplained symptoms are subjectively real somatoform disorders that cause very disabling symptoms for the people who are experiencing them. But these are happening without any apparent physical cause. So this seems that there's nothing physically wrong. And these can take many forms, such as pain, gastrointestinal disorders, sexual dysfunction, pseudoneurological disorders. And these can range from the tendencies to experience normal bodily sensations as being very unpleasant or disturbing, right through to very severe physical deficits. And these deficits tend to be based on the beliefs of the person who is experiencing them. So, for example, we've had a patient who reports having triple vision, which isn't possible because human beings only have two eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have double vision when the two eyes don't converge properly, but there's no third visual input, so it's not possible to have triple vision. But for this person, it seems very real. And or other examples could be numbness of the hands following a glove-like pattern. So this isn't consistent at all with the nerves in the hand or the way that the hand's represented in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very consistent with how the patient believes that the nerves are in the hand.
Right, and all this is your brain playing tricks on you.
Yes. So you find that drug treatment really doesn't work because there's nothing for the drug to actually treat.
Right.
So sham surgery can help in some cases, and this is where the patient believes that they've had surgical intervention. Actually, they've had an anesthetic, they've been cut open, and then the surgeon's just sat
can't
there for
find
a bit.
The problem.
So there's nothing really there. But generally, these need to be treated psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say that this is always the case for somebody who presents with multiple symptoms that don't seem to have a cause. But it's been estimated that these kind of problems account for about 33% of presentations to initial presentations to a doctor. And I should point out that this isn't people making this up. It's not that they're putting it on. It's not hypochondriasis. These people really believe that this is actually what's happening to them. And it's very debilitating and very upsetting. And it really sort of indicates to us how powerful belief is in influencing health. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we know that in terms of pain relief, if you give people tablets that are in capsule format rather than tablet format, the pain relief medication works better, despite the fact that there's actually no difference at all in the painkillers. People believe that it's sort of more scientifically advanced, that the technology is better, and therefore the painkiller will work faster and more effectively. And because of this belief, the painkiller does work faster and more effectively.
So when you see it's all in your head, it is true then, it's all in your head.
This is true, yes.
Perhaps I could give an example to illustrate this point. My nephew, Chris, Big Chris he is, had an accident a few years ago on his motorbike. Chris lives on the Isle of Man, which is in the Irish Sea between England and Ireland. Mm-hmm. And living on the Isle of Man, he became quite a fan of the TT circuit. And he got a motorbike and he started riding around this circuit. And one day he went a little bit too quickly around one of the corners and he came off his motorbike. And he suffered an injury which, well, basically strained his neck. It sort of pushed his head sideways a bit and it caused the nerves to sever in his neck that were feeding his arm and taking information from his arm. And it was quite a bad accident. It has caused his arm to become paralyzed, and it means that he can't feel any sensation in his arm. This happened maybe as long as 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. How old was he at that time?
I think he was around about 25.
Okay.
And there's no prospect of recovery. His arm isn't going to recover, and he is not going to feel sensation. He isn't going to be able to use his arm. But he reports that he experiences quite a lot of pain in his arm, and he's been going to see a consultant in Liverpool in the UK who said to him, well, I think perhaps what we need to do is to amputate your arm and then the pain will go away. So I think Kirsten has a particular view on this.
I don't necessarily believe that that's going to help at all, because what you find with people who have amputations is that about 96% of these people end up having what's called phantom limb pain. So they'll have quite severe pain in a limb that's actually not there at all. And I believe that what Chris may be suffering is similar to this, because it's not due to the fact that the limb is gone, it's due to the fact that the nerves connecting the limb are gone. So I believe that he's suffering a bit of phantom limb pain, even though the limb is still attached, mm-hmm. because he's completely unable to feel any sensation in this area, and he's still receiving pain messages from this area of his body.
How would you diagnose this sort of condition, and how would you treat it?
I think the diagnosis is fairly obvious, because clearly he's paralyzed, yeah. and he can't feel any sensation. He's not able to control his arm, and yet he is suffering, or he believes that he's suffering very severe pain. It is quite severe. He can't sleep very well at night, and he suffers throughout the day, every day. But the question how to treat it, I think, is very interesting, and I'm sure Kirsten has a view on this.
Your solution.
Yeah. Well, it very much depends on exactly what's causing the pain. So it's possible that the nerves themselves were quite damaged when they were torn, so they could be sending a pain signal constantly. So trimming the nerves in this case would probably be quite effective. But it's also possible that he's having this phantom limb pain, in which case there's a particular treatment that we used in Glasgow that I was working a few years ago, where patients who had quite severe pain were put in what we call a mirror box. So patients who had a missing upper limb, who were in a lot of pain, we put them in a mirror box, and what the mirror box does is reflect their good arm over to the side of the bad arm. So it looks very much to them like they now have both arms back intact. And what they can do is then move the good arm that they can see to perform whatever the action is that they feel they need to relieve the pain in the amputated limb. So you find that, for example, a patient who says that they feel that their upper limb is very clenched, even though it's no longer there, if they can see themselves moving and unclenching a working arm, this actually mitigates a lot of the pain that they're feeling. And we found this for people who've had all levels of amputations, and also for a lot of time since the amputation.
Wow. Didn't realize that.
It's quite fascinating.
It is very fascinating. Now, just to digress a little, we have a question here from a listener. Does the brain atrophy with age if it's kept active?
So the brain will atrophy with age. That is unfortunately unavoidable. But the more active your brain is, the better you will do. So we have what are called a cognitive buffer. So I always used to tell my patients it's basically a use it or lose it basis. So, you know, if you continue to have a very active mind, then it will stay active into older age. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you tend not to use your mind, then if you go to use it in later life, it may not be there to be used.
Okay.
So as Peter was saying, it's quite similar to exercising your muscles.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, you've done so much work with fMRIs and EEGs to try and measure this or understand the brain activity. But why is it we are unable to find out the causes of Alzheimer's and things like that?
Alzheimer's is actually quite well documented as causes. So it's a chromosomal disorder. So it's a disorder of chromosomes 1, 2 and 14. And basically what happens is that there's a particular protein that the brain builds up called presenilin that isn't cleaned out the way that it should be. So this leads to what are called beta amyloid plaques and neurofilary tangles, which kind of, if you like, clutter up the brain and cause problems. And this is what causes Alzheimer's. So it's actually a repeating amino acid that chain on these chromosomes that cause this. So it's very much genetic. But what we don't know is how we could possibly change the chromosomes to be able to prevent this.
Right.
But if I might add to that, I mean,
sure. You
know, we can use these technologies to discover all sorts of things that we didn't already know. And one example that was in the news recently was the case of somebody who appeared to be in a coma, somebody who had an accident. I don't know what the actual accident was, but they'd obviously had a bang on the head, and it had put them into a coma. And what the doctors couldn't determine was whether this person's cortex was functioning at all. The person wasn't showing any signs of responsiveness in the behavior. They weren't showing any signs of movements in their limbs, not even any eye movements. Now, one thing that we can do in some cases, if a person is completely paralyzed, we can still communicate with them by asking them questions and asking them to move their eyes in a certain way, like move your eye left, or move your eye left if you want to say yes, and move it right if you want to say no.
Mm-hmm.
And we're able to communicate in a very basic way with people like that.
Yeah.
But there are some cases where the person is damaged so severely that they can't move anything, not even their eye movements. Now, there was one such case where a person was in a coma. They weren't able to move in any way whatsoever. And they are put into an fMRI scanner, and they are given the instructions, if you want to answer yes, then think about playing tennis. If you want to answer no, think about listening to music. And then a series of questions was presented to this person, and the scanner was able to detect that either the auditory cortex was active or the motor cortex was active. And that corresponded with either a yes or no response. Because if it's listening to music, you expect the auditory cortex to be active. If it's playing tennis, you expect the motor cortex to be active. So simply by thinking of something, this patient was able to communicate and yes or no answers, which in the process determined that they had some level of conscious activity. If we hadn't been able to put them in an MRI scanner, then there would have been absolutely no evidence that there was any sign of consciousness.
Would this help, though? I mean, I don't know how far this question is actually going to be relevant, but will understanding how fMRIs work and its applications, will it help people when they're withholding and withdrawing a person from life support? I mean, you're not sure. I mean, you're in a dilemma. You don't know whether this person might come out of the coma. You know, can an fMRI help?
It's a very difficult ethical decision. Mm-hmm. But one thing that might inform that decision is whether the person is showing signs of conscious activity. In other words, if you ask them a question, can they respond yes or no? So if there's a sign of conscious activity, I think that's something that you'd want to know if you are contemplating switching off life support.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And just quickly, if you could just explain the differences between a person who's in a coma, a person who's in a vegetative state, and a person who's brain dead. What's the difference?
I guess somebody who is brain dead is somebody who is not showing any kind of activity at all in the brain, and they might be alive by virtue of the life support okay. systems. Somebody who is in a coma is somebody who is perhaps not showing, or this is somebody who's not able to gain consciousness. You might be able to detect levels of activity in different parts of the brain, but they're not able to show consciousness. Somebody who's in a vegetative state is somebody who perhaps for a very long period of time is in a condition where we're not seeing signs of activity in the brain. The lower parts of the brain might be working to keep the vital functions going, but there's no evidence that the higher levels of brain activity are present.
Okay. What would you like us to take away from an interview like this? We have gone to fMRIs, to EEGs, to illusory sensations. What would you like us, the one thing that you'd like us to understand?
Basically just that your brain is the most important thing to you, really. It dictates everything that you do, everything that you are. And so it's very important to look after your brain and also think nice things of it. So as we talked about, your belief in your health is very important in influencing your health. So if you are going to stay happy and healthy, you need to believe that you're going to stay that way.
And the brain is one of the most remarkable organs that's ever developed in the universe. And it's been a great mystery to scientists and philosophers ever since we've existed on Earth. And now, for the first time, we're beginning to unlock the mysteries with these new kinds of technologies where we can see an image, not just like an X-ray of the static brain, but an image of the brain as it works. And this holds the potential of showing us how the brain is doing its job, what parts of the brain are responsible for what kind of mental activity. And for the first time, we can begin to know the answer to these questions.
Mm-hmm. When will your research be published, Dr. Kirsten?
Hopefully a little bit later this year.
Okay, great news. If you can just take one more question before we leave.
Yeah, sure.
What are the important nutrients which can maximize our brain function, and how important is sugar for our brain? are you in a position to answer that question?
I could give you a fairly concise answer to that.
Sure.
You really don't want to have too much sugar. So it's very important to have a certain amount of fat, because a lot of neural cells are actually covered in fat. It's called myelin, and it's a way of making the neurons communicate faster. So if you're not receiving enough fat, then you're actually damaging your brain. So you need to have around about 20% fat in your diet. So you shouldn't try and have an entirely low-fat or no-fat diet at all. It's fine to have a bit of sugar, but I would generally avoid having too much because it can change your metabolism too quickly. This changes insulin levels, which can affect your ability to think quickly or think properly as well.
Okay. What are the important nutrients?
It's a good question, actually. A good question.
To maximize brain function.
Yeah.
We hear of, you know, memory-enhancing supplements. Do they really work?
A colleague of mine, somebody called Professor David Benton from the University of Wales, Swansea, investigated this very topic maybe 20 years ago now, and he's been investigating it ever since, in fact. He came to visit Malaysia a few months ago, and he's planning to do a study here, actually. But 20 years ago when he started this research, a teacher from a school in Wales came to visit him and said, "I'm a bit worried about my children. The children in my class seem to be not as smart as they ought to be. And my theory," this teacher said, "is that they're eating too much junk food. What can you do about it, Professor?" And David Benton said, "Well, maybe it's that because they eat so much junk food, they're not taking enough vitamins. So why don't we give the kids a supplement of vitamins and see if it causes an increase in IQ?" So over the ensuing 3 months, that's exactly what they did. They gave some kids vitamin tablets and they gave some kids placebo, which looked exactly the same, but they had no active ingredient.
Yeah.
And at the end of 3 months, they measured the kids' IQ, and those who had the vitamin supplement showed a gain, I think on average, if I remember correctly, 3 points in IQ. And the kids who had the placebo, the inactive ingredient, showed no gain whatsoever, as you would expect.
Yeah.
And this was then screened on the BBC in a QED documentary, which was very popular in the UK. And the following day, the company that had sponsored this research, a pharmaceutical company, then put out some bottles of tablets in pharmacies, and they said, as shown on TV, and they called them IQ tablets. Mm-hmm. And IQ, in the small print, said the ideal quota of vitamins, and they sold out within a week, actually.
Wow.
But anyway, it turned out that if the kids have a low level of vitamins, then you can see gains like this if you give a vitamin supplement. But in further studies, if the kids that you were treating already had a good diet and already had a decent level of vitamins, then giving them extra vitamins made no difference. So I think the message from this story is that as the kids have a decent, balanced diet, then we don't need to take any further action. In other words, if you give them more vitamins and they already have a good diet, it's not going to make them super intelligent.
Right, but it will help.
It will help kids who don't have a good diet.
Right. You mentioned 20% fat in the brain. What if your diet consists of a very high fat diet? Will that affect the brain?
So it's more likely to affect your blood flow, because if you have a very high fat diet, you tend to find that you make more fat deposits on the body, you become more sedentary. And what you find is that this kind of slows the whole process down in the brain. Oxygenated blood is going through more slowly. Neurological firing is going slower because the oxygenation is slower. So it has a knock-on effect to the brain.
Okay.
So it's not a direct effect, but it will certainly have an effect.
Okay, I can talk about this all day. I have a million other questions, but we're probably going to pick this up again sometime in the future. Thank you both for joining us. Professor Peter Mitchell, the editor of the British Journal of Psychology, and Dr. Kirsten McKenzie, Doctor of Philosophy in Cognitive Neuroscience. And us trying to understand the brain on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, the business station.